This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Kadu Lin Shud. I want to thank Abbot Mio for inviting me to speak here today. When I first went to Tassajara, Mio was the Tanto, and I got my Zazen instruction from him. And I have to admit that I feel a little nervous. It kind of feels like I'm, you know, since I started, I went to Tassajara not having done Zen before. I went for the summer to stay one practice period only and ended up staying 3.5 years. In a way, I kind of feel like now I'm giving a talk in front of Mio. It's like the beginning again, so it makes me a little nervous. I know we're supposed to cultivate that, but the feeling of it is nervousness, at least in this moment. In terms of Hartford, I actually was introduced to Hartford by John King. And I knew John from Reverend, I don't know his Dharma name, we have the same teacher, Blanche Hartman, and also while we practice in different school, we practice tea, the way of tea. And so John introduced me to Hartford actually by the garden. He was very proud of the garden here. He took me through the garden. And I can't remember, something was happening in here because we actually didn't come into the Zendo. And since then, thanks to Terry's invitation, I've been the guest teacher on the first Tuesday of the month for the women's group that was started here in September. So it's kind of familiar and kind of not. Today I want to give a talk. I want to start out actually about another monk who has also passed from us. Says John, and that's about Abbot, who was the central abbot at San Francisco Zen Center, Yogan Steve Stuckey. People here know who he is. Yes. Tomorrow's the funeral at Green Gulch Farm for him, and I know Abbot Steve. I began in a training program, a priest training program called SPOT. Grace is also part of that, and Darlene Cohen, Lou Richmond, and Abbot Steve were the teachers when I was in it. And I knew him from that, and then also from in 2012 and 2013, we were working together with other people at Zen Center, mostly City Center, on some inclusivity issues. As who here doesn't know Steve? Do I need to go a little bit into? So he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in early November. October. In September, he wasn't feeling well and had some inkling about it September 30th, and then was diagnosed October 2nd, and that it at stage 4, there's no other stages, and it also spread to his, at that time, to his lungs, liver, and spleen. So he was given 3 to 6 months to live. He had a lot of pain. So this is from October 10th. They had a blog called Subtle Eye. Myogen means subtle eye. And here's one of his posts, October 10th. Dear ones, it seems impossible that only 10 days have passed since Lane, that's his wife, and I received the report that the CAT scan results show lesion and a mass consistent with pancreatic cancer. 2 days ago, October 10th, the diagnosis was confirmed. A biopsy last Friday, October 4th, determined that I have cancer that spread. I have been surprised by the intensity of pain that I feel and we are working to determine what pain medication and what dose will help ease that pain. He's also lost his appetite, and he ends by saying, "In keeping with my current moment-by-moment practice of gratitude, I would like to acknowledge all those many people from the 10 directions who are chanting for my well-being. I've been touched by the countless messages of love and support from family members, friends, and Sangha." So at that time, and since then, a koan came up for me that I've been carrying around. Do I need to say something about koans? Y'all probably know a little bit about koan. They're teaching stories from 13th century China, the bulk of them. Dogen, of course, had his commentaries on them. And the way we practice with it, or my experience with it, is not so much in the Rinzai tradition where, you know, go in and give the right answer. I had a little experience of that in Japan. But our way, or my way, that I practice with Blanche is much more, you kind of carry it around. You don't just chew on it so hard, maybe that's my understanding in the Rinzai, but more carry it around and see how it informs your life. And not so much looking for an answer, per se. And what I appreciate about koans, or at least my experience with them, that they help you, because often the saying in them don't seem to make any sense in our rational, kind of typical way of problem solving, and that's part of the practice, you know. You try so hard to be rational and figure out the right answer. But in fact, one of the main intention of them is that they give you an opportunity in which your mind kind of, what I call, kind of just goes, huh? Right? It kind of has a gap from your habitual kind of way of thinking. And in that moment, perhaps a new way or a different way of looking at what is happening with you can emerge. So the koan that comes up for me since hearing about Abbot Steve is this one. It's from the Mumen Khan, the Gateless Gate, or the Gateless Barrier, number 37. Joshu Oak Tree in the Garden. A monk asked Joshu, "With what intention did Bodhidharma come to China?" Joshu answered, "The oak tree in the front garden." What do people think about when I say oak tree? Want to say? The oak tree in the front garden. What might come up for you?
Big and strong.
Big and strong. Mm. There's no right answer in this space. No bell ringing here. Unless me always inspired.
Wide.
Wide.
Growth.
Anyone else?
Deep roots.
It's just there.
All right. So in terms of how it relates to Abbot Steve for me, is this. By the way, sometimes in some translation, it's the cypress tree in the front garden. So Bodhidharma may or may not have been a real person, or perhaps a compilation of people, but we understand him in the Zen tradition to be someone who brought Zen from India to China, right? Or that style of practice. And so the question arises for me, and I think this is what can happen when we meet those moments in our life where our mind kind of on life in itself is the koan, right? Where we just go, huh? You know, like hearing about the diagnosis and the suddenness of his ill health, to me kind of brings up that question of what is practice? You know, what did Bodhidharma bring? What kind of practice does he bring? So for us, like in that moment, it's like, well, what am I doing here? What am I doing when I come to, you know, Hartford or Zen Center or sit down on my cushion. And Joshu's answer is the oak tree in the front garden. Mumin, the compiler, the Mumin Khan, has a commentary, right? He says, words do not express fact. Phrases do not reveal the delicate motion of mind. He who accepts words is lost. He who adheres to phrases is deluded. So these echoes for line attributed to Bodhidharma, a special transmission outside the scriptures, not founded upon words and letters, by pointing directly to one's mind, it lets one see into one's own true nature and thus attain Buddhahood. So I think for many of us, we come to practice and our typical way of approaching practice, I certainly know it was mine, or is mine, continues, often is to learn, to study, to try hard, to make a lot of effort. And in that, there's a certain seeking, right, outside ourselves. How can I, you know, bow correctly? How can I, like today, you know, I haven't sat in here in a formal way, so I was like, well, which side of the altar do I need to come in, you know, and Mio had to tell me the form here, which is, you know, similar to City Center, Zen Center, but a little bit different. So that's part of our life, and that's how we often approach practice. In a way, kind of with this grasping to make sure I am doing it right, that I know what I'm doing, that I'm practicing correctly. So that oak tree, though, that oak tree says to me is that it's right there in my front garden, in the front garden, right? Right there where we can look at what is going on. Our practice, in a way, the forms is the oak tree. It gives us something to focus on, which we think at first is outside of ourselves, right? We spend a lot of time trying to figure out the outer things, which is part of the process. There's nothing wrong in that. And yet, the oak tree or the forms is not the thing itself. Or our idea about the oak tree, while valid and useful, big and strong, deep roots, growth, those things are valid and have validity and resonates for us, and they in themselves are not the tree itself. How you carry the incense, put it in, how you bow is part of the practice, but as long as you just keep it at the thinking about, well, am I doing it right or not, or my hand is shaking, right, then I'm not just putting the incense in the incense. Make sense? So there's still a gap. So it's more of a description of what's going on as opposed to what's happening. So the two lines, the second set of two lines, talks about how our mind works, right? By pointing directly to one's mind, it lets one see into one's own true nature and thus attain Buddhahood. Or more succinctly, Buddhadharma also said, the mind is the root from which all things grow. If you can understand the mind, everything else is included. So if we understand the mind first by really experiencing fully what is happening, right? In moments of discomfort and pain, such as hearing about someone you care about dying. We want to turn towards that, our usual way, our habitual way, before we come to practice and stick with practice, is to turn away from that. Right? So we begin by really being with our pain, turning towards it, and building the capacity to be with it. Right? Again, this is from the blog, October 14th. This is posted by Mary, Steve's assistant. Dear friends, yesterday morning, this October 13th, Ling took Abbot Steve to the emergency room because of fever and inflammation on his legs. After being assessed, he was admitted into the hospital. They found an infection in his leg and they were treating it with antibiotics. And he also had blood clots, so they were giving him blood thinners. Also, this morning his heart began beating at an irregular pattern, which they are treating and monitoring closely. His heart has been working very hard as a response to the intense pain he has been experiencing. So they're trying to control the pain. He's got oxygen and intravenous fluids because he's having a hard time taking a full breath. Abbot Steve told me that it was a very good thing to be in the hospital at this time because they are best able to monitor and treat all these health concerns. He asked me again to mention that all of your questions and well wishes should come to me. Abbot Steve remains grateful for all your support and well wishes. That's the part I really want to bring out. Most importantly, he feels a tremendous sense of gratitude for his current ability to stick with his body's reactions to this condition moment by moment. Staying with your knee pain or your ankle pain or your emotional pain, you know, in the process of practice or your mental pain helps us, gives us a capacity and an ability to be with moments of pain that we can't turn away from. Right? And one way, you know, great way, which I know that Steve and Darlene really emphasize in the spot training, is to be able to be, to know your painful experience, the difference between the sensation of the discomfort you're having, be it your knee pain, right, or your back pain where you're sitting, versus the mental kind of pain or suffering that you have. So focusing on the actual sensation of where you're having discomfort. And the same thing if it's an emotional, let's say you feel grief, right? So if you can focus on, not on the concepts of what is, seems to be causing the grief, which doesn't mean that, I'm not saying that's not valid, right? Hearing someone you care about is gonna die would bring up grief, and did bring up grief for me. And by that I don't mean to suppress it, but and part of our practice is to be able then to be with it. And one great way to do that is to bring it down into the actual body experience, right? Like talking about it now, I have pressure here, right? And my throat is clenching, right? So it's kind of squeezing, and that's pressure feeling down, pushing down. And so if I can stay with the physical sensation discomfort, it's helpful because of several things. One, I can note that it changes, right? Two, because I'm locating it in my body, it takes me out of that circular story that could be going in the head. You know, not that the story doesn't have validity. I want to say that, right? He's dying. That's a big thing, right? Or he's dead at this point, right? So, and if I can stay with the sensation, I can see, one, I'm more present with what's happening in the physical body. Two, I note that it can change. And three, it gives it less of a sense of that it's about me, right? That's about me. It's the grief is not, it's not so much the grief is, I cannot bear the grief. I think for me, oftentimes when I'm sad, I think I just can't bear it. I just can't bear it. But if I can just focus on the sensation, then often there's a sense that, yes, it's uncomfortable and diseaseful and unsatisfactory, and yet it's bearable. Does that make sense? and the noting the changes of it, the pressure changing to clenching, or perhaps even easing, right, at times, and that it's not a constant, helps to be able to be with it more. So that part that it's not so much a personal experience is really also important, right? As Dogen puts it, right, in the Genjo Koan, right, to carry yourself forward and experience mirrored things is delusion. That mirrored things come forth and experience themselves is awakening. My sadness, my grief, right, is sadness, and if I bring an idea to it, oh, so many people have died in my life, here's another person who's dying, and then I miss what this sadness itself is bringing up. Does that make sense? If I cannot focus so much on my past experience, my ideas about grief, and can just be with the current grief, then it becomes not so heavy and solid in the sense of, this is yet another thing happening to me. Does that make sense for people? So it helps us to see that the grief itself is something that's showing itself to us, right? The quality of sadness. For instance, I've had a lot of grief in my life. My birth mother died when I was 8, and many people I know have died. And I know that at one point I just could not think that I would survive if I could just give in to my grief completely. Yeah. And there was a moment in which I was at a retreat, and I just broke down and cried about my mother's death. She died when I was 8. I'm like 32 when this is happening, right? You know, snot everywhere. I literally like fell on my knees and hands and knees, right? And yet when I could just give in to the grief and cry completely, then it actually was over so much faster. And I also realized that I wasn't so tired afterwards. People have that experience, because my experience before was that I would just be so tired after I cried. And when this other experience happened to me, I realized that the tiredness came because I would, even in the midst of crying, I would go, I can't survive this. I don't want to cry. I don't want to be grieving. And so the tiredness came from the resistance to actually experiencing sadness and grief. And so when I can let go of my ideas about what it would mean to be sad completely, just be sad, then it actually passed so much quicker and was refreshing in a way, right? I mean, I don't go looking for it, mind you, but when it happens, I'm more open to it, and I feel it fully, and then it is cared for, and it's just, it settles much faster. That's my experience. Let me just do a little time check here. Here's a story about a tree, which I think describes that. When I was in college, I started at University of North Dakota, and I was an English major, and they had a writer's conference, right? And it was on science fiction. I'm like 18, right? And I'm like, I don't read science fiction, right? But I'm an English major, so the teacher said, you have to go, right? Teachers. So I went, and I actually was really, it was really amazing for me. Harlan Ellison was there, and I don't know, I can't remember all the names now. Do people know who Harlan Ellison is?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. He was pretty big in the 80s and 90s. He even did a commercial for some car that was new and small at the time in the 80s, right? He writes kind of what they call fantasy, not the shoot 'em up kind of science fiction, more like fantasy, right? What happens when a crocodile, baby alligators are flushed down the toilet? You know, there was a story where there's like a little, in the sewer, they had a whole society, basically, things like that. So there's a story that I remember that just, I was so taken off with, and it's this. I don't remember the name of the story. I should go look it up. So the story was about the perspective from a tree, right? And this tree was in a corner in a country lane. And the story was that the tree, like when it was in the country lane, was out, you know, where very few cars came. And the tree is saying that, you know, like when a car is coming down the road, it had to watch the car because it had to become bigger as the car got nearer, right? And then when it got busier and busier as the city started encroaching out, it was very busy, like becoming bigger for so many different cars and smaller for some, right? And that, and then at the end, a car ran into it. That was the story. And I don't remember really what all the nuances. The thing that was, for me, you know, that little gap that opens up, was like, usually, you know, I think I'm driving in a car and the tree gets bigger because I'm getting closer to the tree. And so for me, the story was like, the tree is the one that's making itself bigger for me. Does that make sense? That's why I went, you know, like, so this is how we go through life. We think, it's my experience. I'm driving. The tree's getting bigger because I'm getting closer to it, right? I'm going out to meet the tree. There's this delusion that the tree has its own life and its own experience in relation to me, right? So, of course, there's still subject and object in that story. So another way to look at our experience or how we can be in our life, right, be with the oak tree, is that it's beyond the idea of object and subject. It's not just me experiencing the tree or the tree responding to me, but what is it that's the process of the world? What is it is the process of each of us being in this world? So we're part of the mirrored things, right? And our experience is important. Be aware when you're driving a car, right? But it's not the only one. So, you know, we often hear that the many and the one, and then they're not separated. And one way I understand that is that we each have experience, so there are many experiences. And if we can hold that one is not necessarily more important, which doesn't mean that some don't come to the forefront at times, right? But that the fact is we have to remember that my experience is important, and how else is there that other things have its experience, and how else is it that I can experience things differently, right? And that the key to all that is that we all have our experiences. So another way I've been thinking about that is this, and see if it works for you. Again, it starts with me, right? Do you remember, I think it was in third grade or fourth grade, I can't remember, in elementary school, when you start learning about cell structure, and you have this experience, I remember first we pulled out a hair, right? And then the what is it, the wax or whatever that's at the end of the follicle? People know, you put it under this microscope, and you see, oh yeah, there's that little bulbous thing, and wax or something that's around it. That's what we started. Then we took a little scraping of our skin, and put that on in the microscope too, and looked in it on a slide, and then in the microscope, and then you could see the cell structure, right? You remember the outside and the nucleus, right? And then you got to watch a movie of a one-cell amoeba, right? Do you guys remember those? And I confess I had to look this up, though I had to memorize it, right? Learn it and memorize it at the time. But so if you look at a amoeba, it had the ectoplasm, which is like the outside structure, right, remember? And then the endoplasm, it's the mushy part on the inside between the outer skin cell structure and the nucleus, right? And then I don't know whether it was the, they were always on those reel-to-reel kind of movies, right? And so, and then the sound of that, do you remember the sound of that? Kind of, right? And then also, the amoeba always seemed to like, maybe because it was time lapse, you know, but always seemed to like pulse with life, right? So, to me, you know, first the interest was like, oh, I'm different than I think I am. I'm made up of cells, right? Or my hair is not the way I think my hair is. Then, you know, so you have to learn the parts in school. It's interesting. And then you learn, at some point, again, maybe because of all that stuff happening, but whenever I think of an amoeba, I told you, I had to look up what the parts of the cell is, but the part I don't have to remember or I have access to at all time is the aliveness of the amoeba, especially when that arm reaches out, you know, covers up, what was it, a paramecium, right? And then it ingests it, do you remember? I mean, we all can, that's the part that I really, the aliveness, right, of it. And so I think it's like that, you know, we have to really know what's happening with ourselves, and in that we can understand what happens with others that we come in contact with, not just human beings, but grass, trees, and walls, tiles, right? And then in that itself, that we're all the process of life. So, at moments in which our mind is interrupted, right, from its habitual story of ourselves and our life, of myself and my life, especially the ones that says this is how things should be. So old age, sickness, and death helps us to recognize the limits of this life. The impermanent and fragility of this body, this heart, and this mind. These are the things, too, that brought the Buddha to go searching, right, for his awakening. So events like this can bring up the same desires for us, right? At such time, perhaps we can reflect on, right, how is it that we're living this very life, and what's most important? What are we doing here, when we come here, and just in each moment? So here's Abbot Steve Death Poem, which is a Zen tradition. In fact, in the tradition, you can write a death poem at different parts of your life. You don't have to wait until you die, or are dying. This human body truly is the entire cosmos. Each breath of mine is equally one of yours, my darling. This tender abiding in my life is the fierce glowing fire of inner earth, linking with all pre-phenomena, flashing to the distant horizon. From right here now to just this. Now the horizon itself drops away. Bodhisattva. That was written on the 27th of December. He died 4 days later, on Tuesday, December 31st. The obituary posted on the San Francisco Sangha News blog was going through stages of his life. Here's a part of it. From 1983 to 2006, Steve supported his family as a householder priest by designing and building many gardens as a landscape designer contractor, living in Mill Valleys, San Rafael, and Rohnert Park. Not surprisingly, as a Zen teacher, he was known for emphasizing a solid respect for the earth and the environment, as reflected in statements such as, quote this from Steve, "Each human body is independent and simultaneously the entire earth. A tree is as much a part of me as my shoulder. I'm very grateful to have this practice. It sustains me and will continue to sustain me to the last moment of consciousness." They didn't reference when he said this, but it's pretty amazing, don't you think? Do people know what kind of tree is in your front garden here?
Metrosideros.
A what?
Metrosideros.
Is there a common name?
New Zealand Christmas tree.
Metrosexual, you said?
Commonly called a New Zealand Christmas tree.
Ah, yes. I looked out and I thought, you know, it was not a native. New Zealand Christmas tree. So please go take at the New Zealand metrosexual Christmas tree. Or your own tree. Thank you for your attention. Is there time for questions? Yes. Comments? Jokes? I take jokes too. Yes, and your name, sir?
Bruce. Thank you for your help. I'm just trying to, as I always do, and not necessarily there has to be, but look for a unity. And so I remembered that you went into some detail of stage four, went into some medical details about that, and then we were, I remember the Bodhidharma question, why did he come from the West? And then I remember your koan. And I'm thinking, well, I guess the whole thing that she was doing from beginning to end was right now, right here, this.
Yes, and what is this? That's the question, right? What is this? I mean, it sounds like he's giving you an answer. Right? There's no question in his answer. But the issue is, do we really know what it is? And mostly we just have an idea of what an oak tree is. We have an idea about our life. We have an idea about practices. So can we just meet it without our ideas, or really more, do we know our ideas when it's that it's just an idea, a concept? Do you really know the oak tree, or only your concept of the oak tree? And do you know when you're, you know, only have a concept, or what's more than your concept? And you can only, in a way, we only know that when we're going, oh, okay, concept, what else is here? And not so much, oh, concept, and replace it with another concept, right? Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Yes. Or speaks to, not answer. Not answer. Anyone else? Yes?
I just wanted to thank you for practicing the great, huge, whole circle you described.
Thank you. Yes, and your name?
Jen.
Jen.
Thank you very much. And the part when you talked about the grief, when you when it came up at age 32 about your mother's death, and it reminded me of this was a hospice for a long time, so there were a lot of people dying, and it wasn't until really after. There was a lot of grieving during the event, there was a lot of joy. But sometimes later something would trigger me and there would be this very deep, cathartic, convulsive grief that would take over. It was very complete. And because you said before, some of the grieving is grieving and then you're tired after, it's not complete. But it seems like sometimes we can't, don't have the space to do, and there's maybe too much pressure at the time of dealing with things. Or so when you were 8 and your mother died, were you with her when she died, or do you?
Not in the last moment.
Not
because.
But you were aware of what was happening with her.
Yes.
When she was dying.
I think part of the issue for me is I actually wasn't even in the same country. I was adopted out. And she did it early, 6 months before she died, because she couldn't afford to have someone care for us. And we didn't have family who she trusted to care for us well. So not being there, I think. But I have been there for my adopted mother's and father's deaths. And so I think that was part of it for me. By saying that, I think if we can just be with our grief, it doesn't mean it's over and it doesn't come back. Do you know, I mean, I still grieve for my mother, my biological mother's death, right? And my experience of my grief is different because I don't spend so much time keeping it away.
Yeah.
I didn't really want to say this because I didn't want to seem like, but so Abbot Steve was kind of told, it wasn't confirmed, right, that he had it, but the doctor said they just have to do the test. And so he gave a talk at Green Gulch Farm like 2 days after he heard. And then he was supposed to give one a week later at City Center, but he had just started chemotherapy, so he didn't have the energy. So they play that tape in the Buddha Hall on a Wednesday night, you know, for the mostly the community. And there were a lot of us. And in it, I actually found myself, tears were just pouring down my face. And yes, I noted like my nose wasn't running, I wasn't shaking, because I probably, you know, one, I had a sense what was coming, right? I was held by the Sangha, I was sitting Zazen, you know, all those things. And there was a moment where I was like, wow, no snot, no, you know, no other stuff. And so to me, that was a gift in the sense that I feel like I was sad completely. And so in a way, there was just less turbulent about being sad. Does that make sense? So it's not, no, by that I don't mean, oh, done in there, done that, it's over. And how do we keep being able to meet our experience as fully as we can in each moment? I'm sure there'll be other times when I'll have lots of snot and, you know, convulsions and all sorts of things. So, thank you. Yes, Sam.
Oh, yeah, thank you for your talk. You talked about grief this morning, about my mother's anniversary of her death on Monday. And I know my practice helped me, you know, not have that convulsive sort of grief that I've had in the past. But I was, you know, I have a question, I guess, you know, you've talked to us as a Sangha and to me personally about, you know, being with the, this is the first I've heard you say, talk about sensation, like, you know, the physical sensation and the pressure. You know, like you said, I asked this once to a teacher as well, like, you know, how does one honor the immediacy of the grief, you know, whether it's the crying, and at the same time acknowledge that it's a natural feeling. It's not ever going to go away. In the case of my mother, probably. I don't know that. I mean, that's a loop I keep telling myself. And how does one... I don't know what I'm saying. But you know, I was struck by you talking about the physical sensation of pressure or like that. You know, is it to treat it like practice, where it's like same as a your leg going to sleep?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. When we practice, in a way, we practice to be. I mean, whatever an X number of minute for you, right? Your leg's going to hurt or your back's going to hurt when you're meditating. You know, even if you're fine in a 40-minute period, maybe in a sesshin, by the third period or sixth period, you're not going to, you know, in 5 minutes, your leg's going to hurt. So we practice to be with that so that at other moments in which things are really difficult, we can relate to it in the same way. And one way I'm suggesting, which I'm surprised the first time you heard it, because I yabber about it all the time, especially in class, right, is the being it with it with just the sensation, so because it helps us to take us away from the story. Not that the story doesn't have validity, but in the moment, if we're overwhelmed by the story and or the emotion, and even what we think the physical pain is, if we can just focus on the actual sensation, it helps us to be with it better, in my experience, more fully. Yes, Craig?
I am. Thank you very much for your talk.
Yes.
Thank you for saying just that you said, because for me, it's the story about the pain,
mm-hmm,
that's the wild part,
mm-hmm,
because I can, when I have the discomfort, it's, mm-hmm, either physical or usually it's emotional,
mm-hmm,
it's the story that keeps it going and keeps feeding it,
mm-hmm,
and the story changes and I'm future tripping.
Mm-hmm.
I'm future tripping on the story. It's going to be different tomorrow. It could be better or worse. I don't know what it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
I have no way of knowing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that feeding that story that's keeping that pain going.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same with some sense of happiness, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be great tomorrow when I'm doing this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm still not in the present.
Mm-hmm.
I may be enjoying a story now because I think, wow, that's going to be great. I'm happy now about something that hasn't occurred yet,
mm-hmm,
you know. So that's just me trying to sort of pull it back a little bit and remembering,
mm-hmm,
to experience now. And if I'm happy now, that's good, but don't make it all about that story.
Mm-hmm.
Just be happy. Thank you.
And I would say you can also practice by turning towards the grasping at the story. What is the sensation of your mind grasping at the story?
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, I will say that I want to be very clear that we don't want to add aversion to our story. Sometimes, you know, if our stories are there because there's something that needs to be worked out.
Mm.
If the story is causing more discomfort, which often it does,
mm,
if you can feel that, if the story, let's say it's about your knee pain, there's a difference between that and like a story, you know, that my mother is dying, right?
Mm.
Maybe, which doesn't mean you shouldn't go to therapy, the difference between therapy and practice, right?
Mm.
And it's also helpful to turn towards, well, what is the, when I cling to the story, what is the physical sensation of mentally clinging to the story?
Mm.
I personally experience, you know, I can already tell right here, back here, a certain tightness that happens when I'm basically gripping a story, be it about my knee or my mother or anything else.
Mm.
So that's another way to be present with what's going on, isn't to push away some other things. If you can just keep turning towards whatever is diseaseful, because usually you're contracting around that in some manner.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I see.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's another way. I think it's great to be able to drop a story, mm-hmm. but we don't want to feed aversion. I'm dropping it because it's bad. I'm dropping it because I shouldn't. Mm-hmm. And that makes me a bad practitioner, or I can't mm-hmm. practice, or mm-hmm. whatever.
Yes, and so I can recognize that story for what it is,
mm-hmm.
and I can even see it as something that's temporary.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, creation of my mind. I can acknowledge it as that much.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. Shall we close, Mio, or
maybe one more?
How about this side of the room, size Jen? Just give you due.
Henry.
No, I don't have a question.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to put on the spot.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for this topic. I, like many other practitioners and people who said we didn't come to meditation, come for reasons of trying to manage pain and to understand that. And at the time when I came back to Zen, because it had been a while, I was suffering greatly in a lot of pain and grief from a relationship. And I found the practice to be very healing, and it was a long process of grief. I was able to breathe through it. I was able to know where it is and feel it fully.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like it was appropriate at the time. And this is where I bring my kind of expectations of what grief should look like and how long it should last.
Mm-hmm.
And I think externally people have their own perceptions of that
sure.
as well. And I can feel that pressure like, this should end now. You should stop feeling these emotions so strongly.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a strange experience of like, I felt I could not indulge, but like really feel it fully. And it's now about 2 years later. And every so often it's like when it comes time for anniversaries or dates that are significant.
Mm-hmm.
I feel it a little bit, and sometimes strongly and sometimes less strongly, but I'm afraid to experience it as I did then because of this notion of like, okay, it should be done, it should be lessened, it
mm-hmm.
should be whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting to hear that 32-year experiencing that as well, and it makes me think of like, well, where is this coming from? What is it that's needed at that point in time? It also makes me think about things that I'm dealing with on a daily basis and fears of pain and not wanting to come back to that. And it's given me a lot to think about.
Mm.
Thank you.
What else besides thinking about it?
Well, how I'm going to approach. Well, it's a different beast now, and I feel like I've got a little bit of pain aversion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in a new relationship, which is also scary, but in a situation where he's epilepsy, so he has seizures,
mm-hmm.
and I keep wanting to control any aspect that I can to avoid having him have a seizure, because it was a seizure that was pretty traumatic, and so things like, I know I can't control it, I know another seizure is going to come eventually, and I try not to think about myself thinking about that. So it's really strange, but and so instead I turn back to like, what is the fear? Is the fear pain? Is the fear like what's going on? And obviously, there's a lot of fear in there and avoidance.
So, do you have a question? Yeah.
The question is, is that appropriate? Like, should I, like, when is it too much to try to control an environment?
When is it too much? When you're suffering or someone else is suffering.
When is it appropriate to just accept a situation? And not?
It's always appropriate to accept. That's our practice. Whether we can and how is what we're, you know, trying at all times. Sorry. Therapy can be appropriate too. Grief counseling groups, no, you know, not to make fun of it, yeah. And I will say that, you know, we are going, oh, I don't want to feel pain. That's why we practice, right? So I hear you. I hear you. And, you know, of course, when you start a new relationship, that's when all the old stuff will come back. You know, with time and experience, we just try to create conditions in which we can meet things better, be it called, you know, practice or therapy or running exercise, you know. Running is great when you've got a lot of grief, my experience, you know, or exercise, I should say. So try different things to see what's helpful. And knowing that you're having the aversion is great because, you know, you can't meet something if you don't know what it is. So that's great. And if you don't want it to affect what's happening now, then perhaps getting some kind of support to work through more of, you know, old stuff so you can be with the new stuff more. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.